as you're going to see, this is very much, I think, work in progress. That's part of a larger program of research for me. So I'm really looking forward to getting some input from all of you and some useful feedback. So I'm going to start not by talking about emergence, but by talking about why it is I'm interested in this material at all, which actually, the answer to that question isn't quite emergence. So I think you might have a better idea of understanding where I'm going to be going in my talk if I understand why I'm interested in this topic at all, this subject matter. So I take it that one reason why effective field theories and why renormalization group techniques in general are an interesting subject matter for philosophers to study is that they provide an intriguing and very rich case study of a branch of applied mathematics, a similar set of mathematical techniques and formalism that gets applied all over the place, right? That gets applied not only in disparate domains of physics, but gets applied in economics, gets applied in all sorts of cases. So my, I guess, leading primary interest in this material is in understanding why it is that this is the case. Why is it that we find that this general set of mathematical techniques, this formalism, is so widely applicable across different domains of physics and beyond? Okay, so that's a sort of question about why, about the applicability of mathematics, which is a not what we're discussing here, but an interesting topic for philosophers. I'm also interested in the question, the broader question of how it is that the interpretation of that gets overlaid on the set of mathematical on the set of techniques or the mathematical formalism affects what sorts of foundational views we take on different on applications of the same formalism in different domains, and more broadly on foundational questions. So, for instance, I take it that one current area of foundational interest is spontaneous symmetry breaking, and whether the analogy that that began in with superconductors or condensed matter physics more generally, the question is how exactly that transfers to particle physics, where it's been very useful heuristically. But how do we understand that physically? How do we understand how we should interpret that once we export that very useful piece, that very useful insight to the particle physics context? Okay, so so I take it that emergence fits into this whole set of interests, especially in this this conference, this workshop where we're talking about emergence in the context of effective field theories. It fits into this interest because my question is, does what we want to say about whether effective field theories count as being genuinely emergent or not hinge on the physical interpretation that we overlay on the mathematical formalism? In particular, is it possible that we could arrive at different judgments in different cases of applications of whether effective field theories are emergent? Okay, so this is how this sort of set of interest ties in to what I'm going to talk about today and to the topic of the conference. Another reason I flagged this interest is that I want to hopefully head off at the outset what might be a confusing use of terminology on my part. So as I've just been sketching, the way I'm thinking about these issues is I'm thinking about renormalization group methods as a set of formal mathematical techniques. By that, I don't mean anything as strong as there's one mathematical formalism and the same mathematical formalism gets applied everywhere. That's clearly not the case. But I take it that there's a similar set of mathematical techniques which fall under the heading of renormalization group methods, and that we should think of that, and that we can think of that those methods as being a set of applied mathematical techniques. Okay, so what are the implications of this view? So sociologically, the implications might be that we should think about renormalization group techniques in the same way we think about advanced calculus for our undergraduate students, right? So advanced calculus gets taught to undergraduates in by applied mathematicians, by the math department. It doesn't get taught in the physics department. So I'm trying to think about renormalization group methods in that kind of way. So I don't know whether a sociological implication might be it should be possible if this is a sensible way of thinking about things, that renormalization group methods could be taught in principle to our graduate students in physics out of the applied math department or the math department. Just going to say one more thing and then I'll let you get in. So this is where things might get confusing, because I recognize, and a feature of textbooks that I've been looking at on this subject doesn't take this point of view, right? So the point of view in particular that gets taken, particularly with the two sort of applications I've been looking at, is you have what I'm calling quantum field theory for particle physics applied to statistical mechanics for critical phenomena, or the other way around. So, I mean, at least with what I've been looking at in physics textbooks, this is what I find, not universally, but often. So I'm mentioning this at the start because, actually, given my broader interests, I'm really interested to hear if this is just a no-go, right? I also want to head off any possible misunderstandings, especially because I'm using this term quantum field theory, right? So for the purposes of this talk today, when I talk about quantum field theory, let me expand on what I mean. What I mean is quantum field theory as it's applied in particle physics. What I do not mean is the title of a textbook has it, quantum field theory in condensed matter systems. Okay, so hopefully that will clear up one sort of possible source of confusion. So what I'm really concerned about is going to be looking at two applications of renormalization group techniques, and a case in which there's also other mathematical analogies, identifications that are made, formal identifications that are driving what's going on. And what I want to do is ask the question, it's been argued that in the case of critical phenomena, do you want to fix this or? All right, let's try that. Okay, so it's been argued that, in particular by Bob, that Bob Batterman, that you can make an argument that in the context of statistical mechanics, thermodynamics, if you prefer the term, of critical phenomena with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, that you do have a case of emergence here. And in particular, the reason why you think you have such a thing has to do with the type of explanations that get deployed when you apply renormalization group methods in this context. Okay, so the structure of the talk, yes, of course, yeah. Good.
You say that it's not one set of methods that's applied. When you say that renormalization group is not one set of methods that's applied to all these different things, so I thought that was the case. So is a distinction you're drawing between, for example, you know, what's called Wilson renormalization group and Gell-Mann-Lowe style renormalization group? Is that what you're talking about, or is there something else that I'm just not understanding?
Okay, so I meant that distinction I didn't want to be too rigid about what I'm putting up here. So I think that there can be a bunch of different similar techniques, right, that count as renormalization group methods.
Well, name two of them that you...
Okay, so I'm thinking here of blocking techniques, for example,
yeah,
that you find in statistical mechanics, and then you have other sort of Wilson ways of formulating the renormalization group. I don't want to be too rigid about what I put up in the box up here. I think that I'm happy to say that there's a whole family of techniques which in the mathematical details get implemented differently, but there's something similar, broadly similar about all of them. Is that answer gonna happen? Is that gonna... So I'm not talking about Gell-Mann-Lowe renormalization group.
Right.
Down here.
So that's the answer to my question is not, you're not talking about the distinction between Gell-Mann-Lowe and Wilson, you're talking about something different. I'll understand as you can.
Yeah,
on.
And I think that's kind of not,
okay,
not
thank
crucial
you
to my point. All right, so the idea here is to try and push this analogy between statistical mechanics, thermodynamics of a critical phenomena, and the intuition that that's a case in which you have a genuine case of emergence because you have novel explanations which are licensed by application of the renormalization group formalism and the effective theory you arrive at. So the intuition is you do have a case of emergence because you have a particular explanatory pattern in that case, question I'm going to be asking is, do you have a sufficiently similar explanatory pattern in the quantum field theory particle physics case, where you also are applying renormalization group techniques, in order to run the same kind of argument that you have a novel explanation of phenomena that can only be given when you have the higher level theory, and when, in particular, when you apply renormalization group techniques. Okay, so for my first step is going to be to look at the argument for critical phenomena, and then to try and extend it by analogy to the particle physics case. Yes? Okay, so that fits in well with what I'm saying then, that you consider... Okay, excellent, thanks, that's good, it's useful. All right. So actually, here's another possible source of confusion that I'll try and head off. In the talk that Bob just gave, he was talking about something slightly different. What I'm going to be talking about here is what he was talking about in the question period. When he was asked to talk about critical exponents, and when he was explaining, I think the sort of thing I'm going to explain quickly right now, why it is we need the higher level theory, why it is we need a renormalization group story in order to explain critical exponents. Okay, so in particular, there's a particular explanatory question we have when we're considering critical phenomena. Why do the order parameters for various physically distinct fluids and even magnets, where the order parameter is the net magnetization, scale as a specific power law? And I put the details there. I don't think with this audience we need to go into it. Okay, so physically distinct materials of all different sorts display the same behavior, that have roughly the same critical exponents. How are we going to explain this? Before I get on to how we explain it, first of all, and I think this is where the crux of my analysis is going to hang, before we even get to thinking about the explanation and why it, or whether it counts as an example of an explanation that's that licenses a claim of emergence, there are a couple of features in this case which seem to make this, at least intuitively, a genuine demand for an explanation. Okay, this seems to be a pressing why question to ask, for a couple of reasons. First of all, as Leo was just explaining in the last break, the phenomena that is requiring an explanation here is and was empirically confirmed. Okay, so experiments were done for a range of systems to confirm that this indeed was the case, and as Leo explained, this was this is where the was comes in. It was the fact that there was this empirical data that required an explanation pushed physicists to realize that mean field theory approaches were not going to be sufficient. Second of all, I take it to be a feature of this particular explanatory why question, demand for an explanation, is that you have unexpectedness cropping up here. That this empirical phenomena is unexpected from the point of view of considering only a single micro theory, right? That why would it be that you end up having the same behavior being exhibited by all sorts of different substances? All right, so that's why you have the demand for an explanation. The explanation is then, the question is then answered with a particular pattern form of explanation, which of course relies on renormalization group reasoning. Okay, so the explanatory answer is going to be that Hamiltonians for physically distinct fluids at their critical points are all in the basin of attraction of the same fixed point. Okay, so elaborate on this. Hamiltonians in the basin of attraction may have different irrelevant couplings, but irrelevant couplings essentially are not going to affect the value of the critical exponent beta. Okay, so this is why, I'm sure this is not necessary for most of you, but here is the sort of picture you get out, a diagram borrowed from Bob, who borrowed it from a paper of Fisher's. So what you have happening is you have a space of Hamiltonians. In this space, you have iron Hamiltonians. You have Hamiltonians for nickel and Gödel Inium. I don't know what that is, but what's important here is that these spaces of Hamiltonians, you start out with the physical ones, and then you apply the renormalization group transformation to get yourself to the critical point. The fact that all of these substances have critical points that flow into the same fixed point of the renormalization group is going to give you your explanation of why it is the critical exponents for all of these substances, which are microscopically quite different, different Hamiltonians, why it is they all have the same critical exponents. Another point to note is that you also have the critical point is, of course, in this diagram is picked out by the critical temperature. So you have temperature also. The Hamiltonians are going to be dependent on temperature. Okay. Yes. So why does that explain the fluid case? Ah, okay, so I've only given you the magnet example, right? So I haven't said anything about fluids. Okay, so then you're going to talk about universality classes, and you're going to broaden beyond Hamiltonians that fit on the same physical page, and then that's what's going to give you the more general explanation.
Okay, so I think you have to have symmetry.
Okay. Right. Okay. So, So what is going to be relevant is going to be the sorts of what is going to determine what sort of fixed point you have is the symmetries of the system, right? And whether they all flow into the same fixed point or not. Right. Okay. So I think. Okay. So for my purposes. All right. I think I can just focus on the fluids. You're right, that what's supposed to be going on here is a more general explanation of universality than just for one class of systems. Yes?
Yeah, would it help to distinguish between emergent phenomena and emergent law? That is, the critical behavior of any single system is not an emergent phenomenon, it is a consequence of the fundamental dynamics, but the law that different critical phenomena characterized only by symmetry
I'm not sure, but bring that back in question period. Okay, so I'm going to skip to what I take to be the crux of what I want to say. So we have the same sort of explanatory answer available to us in particle physics, quantum field theory, in light of the fact that we apply the same sort of methods, renormalization group methods, in the two cases. Okay, so flag, this is a naive attempt at making the connection to an analog, but this is not, as it stands, going to be sufficient. All right, so how do we try to get an explanation of the same sort in quantum field theory for particle physics that we had in the case where we had a whole bunch of different material systems at which have the same critical behavior? So I think the way to do that is to first start by backwards, as it were, by trying to give the same sort of answer and then inferring what the question must be from the fact that we have an answer of a particular sort. Okay, so here's so I've switched here. In order to make the link to quantum field theory, to particle physics, the relevant couplings do not affect the value of the critical exponent or the long-range correlation functions. Then how I make the leap to particle physics from here is that instead of talking about correlation functions, I talk about long-range correlation functions, I talk about low-energy S matrix elements. Okay, so what's my explanatory answer going to be? It's going to be something along these lines. Hamiltonians, Lagrangians in the basis of attraction of the same fixed point have different irrelevant couplings, but irrelevant couplings essentially do not affect the low energy S matrix elements calculated from the effective field theory. Okay, so I say that this is the first attempt at an analog. I'm going to have to add more here. Perhaps what I have to add more is going to be something about symmetry in order to make this statement true. But I need to fix on, I need to reduce the class of from all of the irrelevant couplings to the ones that are going to do what I want
so
this to do. Right. Yes, although I'm trying to stick more closely to my analogy. So here's the explanatory question you get. All right, so the explanatory question is, I think, why is it possible that the observed low-energy S-matrix elements could be produced by a system described by any one of the Hamiltonians, Lagrangians in the basin of attraction of the fixed point? Okay, good. So if the here's a different explanatory question you can ask. Why is it that naive perturbative renormalization techniques work in cases in which they work? Is that the okay, so let me skip to my, am I over 2 minutes? All right, so let me skip to, because I think that's an important point. So what I'm, the point I'm getting to here is by trying to extend, so quantum field theory, particle physics, we're applying the same renormalization group methods, but what we're going to end up with is a much different situation, we're going to be in a much different situation with regard to what sorts of explanations we want, and what sorts of than the statistical mechanics case. Okay, so so I've tried to come up with a question that is the what I take to be an analog of what of the sort of question that you're interested in, that you want an explanation for in the stat-met case, right? In the case of critical phenomena. So the punchline is the question that I've come up with. The demand for an explanation is a demand for an explanation of a much different sort than the one we started out with in the statistical mechanics case. For example, I've switched from talking about having a switched from demanding an explanation for an empirical phenomena, right, that you can go out and test on a whole bunch of different systems, right? So we have all of these. Even stick to one case without getting to the universality class, we have a whole bunch of different ferromagnets that we can then go out and test, right? And we can go out and measure their properties at critical points, near critical points. In the quantum field theory case, we don't have that sort of thing. What we have is an explanation of why it's possible that the unknown physics at high energy scales could be described by a whole one of a host of different Hamiltonians or Lagrangians, right? So the structure of what we have of what sort of explanation this is much different in virtue of the fact that in the stat-met case we have all of these systems available to us that we can do experiments on. That's not how we interpret the same formalism in the particle physics case. Okay, so the differences are going to be we have a whole bunch of different materials we can do the tests on in the stat-met case. We don't in the particle physics case. There's this slide between actual and possible because of this, right? So because we can actually do the experiments on the actually existing materials, if we're presuming that if the high energy theory here is, in fact, a quantum field theory, if we presuming that, then presumably the system does have some particular Hamiltonian Lagrangian, and we're ignorant of what it is. Okay, so the structure is much different in that case. All right, and then the follow-on from that is that all of these differences are going to affect the conclusions we come to about whether the theory is emergent because it licenses novel explanations. Thanks.
Your question, because I thought the mystery was not that you could use any Lagrangian or Hamiltonian in particle physics. On the other hand, people would argue by uniqueness arguments, by denormalizability, Lorentz invariant, there's only one sensible theory you can write for electrodynamics, for example. So it's not that they had many Hamiltonians that gave the same answer, but the reason they weighed towards a unique Hamiltonian with which they could do their business, they were characterized by denormalizability, and that was held as a big virtue, for example, by people like Weinberg. So only much later on it turned out that, yes, you can have other Hamiltonians by adding terms you would never dream of adding in the standard canonical field theories because they're not renormalizable. I thought that was the big mystery and why renormalization works the way it does, why the subtraction works. To me, they were the mysteries that were explained.
So the second mystery is why it is you can add on
I'm saying adding on is a recent thing. In the early days of renormalization theory, it was not adding on, but stripping down to writing basically unique theories for every phenomenon based on just symmetries. For example, you want gauge symmetry, you put gauge symmetry in and put only the renormalizable interactions. And they seem to work. And the mystery was, why is that a great principle? I think we understand it now. It's not a great principle. You can start with whatever you like. That's where you will end up.
Right, if you want an effective low energy theory. Okay, so I want to emphasize how I got to this question, though, right? I didn't get to it through considering the history of renormalization group methods and their application in quantum field theory, in particle physics. I got to it by trying to push the analogy between the statistical mechanics case and the particle physics case. So I think in broad principle, I agree with you that there are going to be different questions here that are interesting in the particle physics case, and that's actually part of my broader point, right, is that what counts as an explanation, what sorts of things we want to be explained is going to, in spite of the fact we have the same formalism, hinge on the interpretation we give to the formalism.
So the basic question you're asking is, you know, where are the interesting differences between the STATMEC and the QFT? And I'd like to back up a bit, start from where Nigel was arguing. I think there's an assumption amongst at least some of the physicists here that one ought to be making them look somewhat the same. And as so Bob talked about, you know, the RG, the renormalization group, which as you're saying is trying to underwrite all of this, and you know, with things like the thermodynamic limit, self-averaging, Gaussian distributions, and so forth. And Nigel underlined that one also has to consider symmetries, order parameters, and I guess he would have also might have added gradient expansions. And Leo says, yes, all of the above plus experiment. And it seems to me this is fine in both fields. I mean, that both of these sets of ideas are, I mean, these ideas are common between QFT and STATMEC. But I'm so glad that Bob had the temerity to introduce a real system in all of this. Still, if you look around you, we're not surrounded by, you know, perfect crystals and superconductors, obeying Ginzburg-Landau theory. We're surrounded by dirty, squalid materials, which are not underwritten by RG. Which don't actually, in general, have a thermodynamic limit. Their properties depend on shape, history, and all sorts of other things. And that seems to me to be a really fundamental difference between, on the one hand, the QFT, as Shankar emphasizes, you know, you've got a pretty good reason believing in one quantum electrodynamic Lagrangian. But we don't for steel. We don't even know, we haven't actually the faintest idea what it should be. And indeed, as one goes to low temperatures, one finds some very peculiar things going on. So it seems to me, I mean, and again, you know, somebody like Parisi would not be too bothered by a non-renormalizable effect of Hamiltonian for a condensed matter system. I mean, we write them down all the time to describe real systems, but you'd be extremely bothered by it in quantum field theory. So I think that the underwriting by RG supposedly works in quantum field theory, but I would claim that for most of the materials in this room, including myself, it doesn't.
So you need to add the symmetries and all the other things in for the condensed matter cases.
So the way that I read your talk, there's a distinction between questions about nature and questions about theories, formal questions about properties of theories. And the argument you're making is that in statistical mechanics, there's a question about nature, and in quantum field theory, there's a question about theory. But there are questions about theory in statistical mechanics that the renormalization group addresses. And I would claim there are questions about nature and particle physics that the renormalization group addresses. So in the shortness of time, it's something we can take up later, but I don't see that distinction.
Okay, that's a nice way of putting the distinction that I was trying to draw.
I think that the addition of a historical perspective to the discussion here is interesting. A philosophical perspective, to some extent, asks how in good logic we would do something. A historical perspective asks how we actually did it, and both things are interesting. I do not see what the slides that appeared here as producing a very, very large distinction between the field theory and the statistical mechanics, but that's only my prejudice, because of my own historical background.
All right. Thanks.